He wore the conqueror's crown, wielded the conqueror's sword, and had been anointed by a septon of the faith before the eyes of tens of thousands. Grand Maester Orwell sat in his councils, and the Lord Commander of the King's Guard had placed the crown upon his princely head, and he was male, which in the eyes of many made him the rightful king, his half-sister, the usurper. Against all that, Rhaenyra's advantages were few. Some older lords might yet recall the oaths they had sworn when she was made Princess of Dragonstone and named her father's heir. There had been a time when she had been well-loved by high-born and commons alike, when they had cheered her as the realm's delight. Many a young lord and noble knight had sought her favour then, though how many would still fight for her now that she was a woman wed, her body aged and thickened by 6 childbirths, was a question none could answer. Though her half-brother had looted their father's treasury, the princess had at her disposal the wealth of House Valerian, and the Sea Snake's fleets gave her superiority at sea. And her consort, Prince Daemon, tried and tempered in the Stepstones, had more experience of warfare than all their foes combined. Last, but far from least, Rhaenyra had her dragons. "As does Aegon," Maester Gerardus pointed out. "We have more," said Princess Rhaenys, the queen who never was, who had been a dragon rider longer than all of them. "And ours are larger and stronger, but for Vega. Dragons thrive best here on Dragonstone." She enumerated for the council. King Aegon had his Sunfire, a splendid beast, though young. Aemond One-Eye rode Vega, and the peril posed by Queen Visenya's mount could not be gainsaid. Queen Helena's mount was Dreamfire, the she-dragon who had once borne the old king's sister Rhaena through the clouds. Prince Daeron's dragon was Tessarion, with her wings dark as cobalt and her claws and crest and belly scales as bright as beaten copper. "That makes 4 dragons of fighting size," said Rhaenys. Queen Helena's twins had their own dragons too, but no more than hatchlings. The usurper's youngest son, Maelor, was possessed only of an egg. Against that, Prince Daemon had Caraxes, and Princess Rhaenyra, Syrax, both huge and formidable beasts. Caraxes especially was fearsome, and no stranger to blood and fire after the Stepstones. Rhaenyra's 3 sons by Laenor Valerian were all dragon riders. Vermax, Arax, and Taraxes were thriving, and growing larger every year. Aegon the Younger, eldest of Rhaenyra's 2 sons by Prince Daemon, commanded the young dragon Stormcloud, though he had yet to mount him. His little brother, Viserys, went everywhere with his egg. Rhaenys's own she-dragon, Melis, the Red Queen, had grown lazy, but remained fearsome when roused. Prince Daemon's twins by Laenor Valerian might yet be dragon riders, too. Baylor's dragon, the slender, pale, green moon dancer, would soon be large enough to bear the girl upon her back. And though her sister Rhaena's egg had hatched a broken thing that died within hours of emerging from the egg, Syrax had recently produced another clutch. One of her eggs had been given to Rhaena, and it was said that the girl slept with it every night, and prayed for a dragon to match her sister's. Moreover, 6 other dragons made their lairs in the smoky caverns of the Dragonmont, above the castle. There was Silverwing, good Queen Alysanne's mount of old, Seasmoke, the pale grey beast that had been the pride and passion of Sir Laenor Valerian, hoary old Vermithor, unridden since the death of King Jaehaerys. And behind the mountain dwelled 3 wild dragons, never claimed nor ridden by any man, living or dead. The small folk had named them Sheep-Stealer, Grey Ghost, and the Cannibal. "Find riders to master Silverwing, Vermithor, and Seasmoke, and we will have 9 dragons against Aegon's 4. Mount and fly their wild kin, and we will number 12, even without Stormcloud," Princess Rhaenys pointed out. "That is how we shall win this war." Lords Celtigar and Staunton agreed. Aegon the Conqueror and his sisters had proved that knights and armies could not stand against fire and blood. Celtigar urged the princess to fly against King's Landing at once, and reduce the city to ash and bone. "And how will that serve us, my lord?" the Sea Snake demanded of him. "We want to rule the city, not burn it to the ground." "It will never come to that," Celtigar insisted. The usurper will have no choice but to oppose us with his own dragons. Our 9 must surely overwhelm his 4.
At what cost? Princess Rhaenyra wondered. My sons would be riding 3 of those dragons, I remind you, and it would not be 9 against 4. I will not be strong enough to fly for some time yet. And who is to ride Silverwing, Vermithor, and Sea Smoke? You, my lord?
I hardly think so. It will be 5 against 4, and 1 of their 4 will be Vega. That is no advantage.
Surprisingly, Prince Daemon agreed with his wife. In the Stepstones, my enemies learned to run and hide when they saw Caraxes' wings or heard his roar, but they had no dragons of their own. It is no easy thing for a man to be a dragon slayer, but dragons can kill dragons and have. Any maester who has ever studied the history of Illyria can tell you that. I will not throw our dragons against the usurpers unless I have no other choice. There are other ways to use them, better ways. Then the prince laid his own strategies before the Black Council. Rhaenyra must have a coronation of her own, to answer Aegon's. Afterward they would send out ravens, calling on the lords of the 7 kingdoms to declare their allegiance to their true queen. We must fight this war with words before we go to battle, the prince declared. The lords of the great houses held the key to victory, Daemon insisted. Their bannermen and vassals would follow where they led. Aegon the usurper had won the allegiance of the Lannisters of Casterly Rock, and Lord Tyrell of Highgarden was a mewling boy in swaddling clothes whose mother, acting as his regent, would most like to line the reach with her over-mighty bannermen the Hightowers, but the rest of the realm's great lords had yet to declare. "Storm's End will stand with us," Princess Rhaenys said. She herself was of that blood on her mother's side, and the late Lord Boromund had always been the staunchest of friends. Prince Daemon had good reason to hope that the Maid of the Vale might bring the Eyrie to their side as well. Aegon would surely seek the support of Pyke, he judged. Only with the support of the Iron Islands could Aegon hope to surpass the strength of House Valerion at sea. But the Iron Men were notoriously fickle, and Dalton Greyjoy loved blood and battle. He might easily be persuaded to support the princess. The north was too remote to be of much import in the fight, the council judged. By the time the Starks gathered their banners and marched south, the war might well be over. Which left only the Riverlords, a notoriously quarrelsome lot, ruled over, in name at least, by House Tully of Riverrun. "We have friends in the Riverlands," the prince said, "though not all of them dare show their colours yet. We need a place where they can gather, a toehold on the mainland large enough to house a sizeable host, and strong enough to hold against whatever forces the usurper can send against us." He showed the lords a map. "Here, Harrenhal." And so it was decided. Prince Daemon would lead the assault on Harrenhal riding Caraxes. Princess Rhaenyra would remain on Dragonstone until she had recovered her strength. The Valerian fleet would close off the gullet, sallying forth from Dragonstone and Driftmark to block all shipping entering or leaving Blackwater Bay. "We do not have the strength to take King's Landing by storm," Prince Daemon said. "No more than our foes could hope to capture Dragonstone. But Aegon is a green boy, and green boys are easily provoked. Mayhaps we can goad him into a rash attack." The Sea Snake would command the fleet, whilst Princess Rhaenys flew overhead to keep their foes from attacking their ships with dragons. Meanwhile, ravens would go forth to Riverrun, the Eyrie, Pyke, and Storm's End, to gain the allegiance of their lords. Then up spoke the queen's eldest son, Jaqeris. "We should bear those messages," he said. "Dragons will win the lords over quicker than ravens." His brother Lucerys agreed, insisting that he and Jace were men, or near enough to make no matter. "Our uncle calls us strongs, but when the lords see us on dragonback, they will know that for a lie. Only Targaryens ride dragons." Mushroom tells us that the Sea Snake grumbled at this, insisting that the 3 boys were Valerians. Yet he smiled as he said it, with pride in his voice. Even young Joffrey chimed in, offering to mount his own dragon, Taraxes, and join his brothers. Princess Rhaenyra forbade that. Joff was but 11. But Jaqeris was 14, Lucerys 13, bold and handsome lads skilled in arms who had long served as squires. If you go as messengers, not as knights, she told them. You must take no part in any fighting. Not until both boys had sworn solemn oaths upon a copy of the seven-pointed star would Her Grace consent to using them as her envoys. It was decided that Jace, being the older of the two, would take the longer, more dangerous task, flying first to the Eyrie to treat with the Lady of the Vale, then to White Harbour to win over Lord Manderley, and lastly to Winterfell to meet with Lord Stark. Luke's mission would be shorter and safer. He was to fly to Storm's End, where it was expected that Boros Baratheon would give him a warm welcome. A hasty coronation was held the next day. The arrival of Ser Stefan Darklyn, late of Aegon's Kingsguard, was an occasion of much joy on Dragonstone, especially when it was learned that he and his fellow loyalists, turncloaks, Ser Otto would name them when offering a reward for their capture, had brought the stolen crown of King Jaehaerys the Conciliator. 300 sets of eyes looked on as Prince Daemon Targaryen placed the old king's crown on the head of his wife, proclaiming her Rhaenyra of House Targaryen, first of her name, Queen of the Andals, the Rhoynar, and the First Man. The prince claimed for himself the style, protector of the realm, and Rhaenyra named her eldest son Jaehaerys, the Prince of Dragonstone and heir to the Iron Throne. Her first act as queen was to declare Ser Otto Hightower and Queen Alicent traitors and rebels. "As for my half-brothers and my sweet sister Helena," she announced, "they have been led astray by the council of evil men. Let them come to Dragonstone, bend the knee, and ask my forgiveness, and I shall gladly spare their lives and take them back into my heart, for they are of my own blood, and no man or woman is as accursed as the Kinslayer." Word of Rhaenyra's coronation reached the Red Keep the next day, to the great displeasure of Aegon II. "My half-sister and my uncle are guilty of high treason," the young king declared. "I want them attainted. I want them arrested. And I want them dead." Cooler heads on the Green Council wished to parley. "The princess must be made to see that her cause is hopeless," Grand Maester Orwell said. "Brother should not war against sister. Send me to her, that we may talk and reach an amicable accord." Aegon would not hear of it. "Septon Eustace tells us that his grace accused the Grand Maester of disloyalty, and spoke of having him thrown into a black cell, with your black friends." When the two queens, his mother Queen Alicent and his wife Queen Helena, spoke in favour of Orwell's proposal, the truculent king gave way reluctantly. So Grand Maester Orwell was dispatched across Blackwater Bay under a peace banner, leading a retinue that included Sir Arik Cargill of the King's Guard and Sir Gawain Hightower of the Gold Cloaks, along with a score of scribes and septons, amongst them Eustace. The terms offered by the king were generous, Monken declares in his true telling. If the princess would acknowledge him as king and make obeisance before the Iron Throne, Aegon II would confirm her in her possession of Dragonstone, and allow the island and castle to pass to her son Jaehaerys upon her death. Her second son, Lucerys, would be recognized as the rightful heir to Driftmark and the lands and holdings of House Valyrian. Her boys by Prince Daemon, Aegon the Younger and Viserys, would be given places of honour at court, the former as the king's squire, the latter as his cupbearer. Pardons would be granted to those lords and knights who had conspired treasonously with her against their true king. Rhaenyra heard these terms in stony silence, then asked Orwell if he remembered her father, King Viserys. "Of course, your grace," the maester answered. "Perhaps you can tell us who he named as his heir and successor," the queen said, her crown upon her head. "You, your grace," Orwell replied. And Rhaenyra nodded and said, "With your own tongue you admit I am your lawful queen. Why, then, do you serve my half-brother, the Pretender?" Monken tells us that Orwell gave a long and erudite reply, citing Andal law and the Great Council of 101. Mushroom claims he stammered and voided his bladder. Whichever is true, his answer did not satisfy Princess Rhaenyra. "A Grand Maester should know the law and serve it," she told Orwell. "You are no Grand Maester, and you bring only shame and dishonour to that chain you wear." As Orwell protested feebly, Rhaenyra's knights stripped his chain of office from his neck and forced him to his knees, whilst the princess bestowed the chain upon her own man, Maester Gerardus, a true and leal servant of the realm and its laws. As she sent Orwell and the other envoys on their way, Rhaenyra said, "Tell my half-brother that I will have my throne, or I will have his head." Long after the dance was done, the singer, Lucian of Tarth, would compose a sad ballad called "Farewell, My Brother," still sung today. The song purports to relate the last meeting between Sir Arik Cargill and his twin Sir Eric, as Orwell's party was boarding the ship that would carry them back to King's Landing. Sir Arik had sworn his sword to Aegon, Sir Eric to Rhaenyra. In the song, each brother tries to persuade the other to change sides. Failing, they exchange declarations of love and part, knowing that when next they meet it will be as enemies. It is possible that such a farewell did indeed take place that day on Dragonstone. However, none of our sources make mention of such. Aegon II was 22, quick to anger and slow to forgive. Rhaenyra's refusal to accept his rule enraged him. "I offered her an honourable peace, and the whore spat in my face," he declared. "What happens next is on her own head." What happened next was war. The Dying of the Dragons. A Son for a Son. Aegon had been proclaimed king in the Dragon Pit, Rhaenyra queen on Dragonstone. All efforts at reconciliation having failed, the Dance of the Dragons now began in earnest. On Driftmark, the Sea Snake's ships set sail from Hull and Spicetown to close the gullet, choking off trade to and from King's Landing. Soon after, Jacaerys Valerian was flying north upon his dragon Vermax, his brother Lucerys south on Arax, whilst Prince Daemon flew Caraxes to the Trident. Let us turn first to Harrenhal. Though large parts of Harren's great folly were in ruins, the castle's towering curtain walls still made it as formidable a stronghold as any in the Riverlands. But Aegon the Dragon had proved it vulnerable from the sky. With its lord, Larys Strong, away in King's Landing, the castle was but lightly garrisoned. Having no wish to suffer the fate of Black Harren, its elderly castellan Sir Simon Strong, uncle to the late Lord Lionel, great-uncle to Lord Larys, was quick to strike his banners when Caraxes lighted atop Kingspire Tower. In addition to the castle, Prince Daemon at a stroke had captured the not inconsiderable wealth of House Strong, and a dozen valuable hostages, amongst them Sir Simon and his grandsons. The castle small folk became his captives as well, amongst them a wet nurse named Alice Rivers. Who was this woman? "A serving wench who dabbled in potions and spells," says Munken. "A woods witch," claims Septon Eustace. "A malign enchantress who bathed in the blood of virgins to preserve her youth," Mushroom would have us believe. Her name suggests bastard birth, but we know little of her father and less of her mother. Munken and Eustace tell us she was sired by Lord Lionel Strong in his callow youth, making her a natural half-sister to his sons Harwin, Breakbones, and Larys, the clubfoot. But Mushroom insists that she was much older, that she was wet nurse to both boys, perhaps even to their father, a generation earlier. Though her own children had all been stillborn, the milk that flowed so abundantly from the breasts of Alice Rivers had nourished countless babes born of other women at Harrenhal. Were she in truth a witch, who lay with demons bringing forth dead children as payment for the knowledge they gave her? Was she a simple-minded slattern, as Eustace believes, a wanton who used her poisons and potions to bind men to her body and soul? Alice Rivers was at least 40 years of age during the Dance of the Dragons. That much is known. Mushroom makes her even older. All agree that she looked younger than her years, but whether this was simple happenstance, or achieved through her practice of the dark arts, men continue to dispute. Whatever her powers, it would seem Daemon Targaryen was immune to them, for little is heard of this supposed sorceress whilst the prince held Harrenhal. The sudden, bloodless fall of Black Harren's seat was counted a great victory for Queen Rhaenyra and her blacks. It served as a sharp reminder of the martial prowess of Prince Daemon and the power of Caraxes, the Bloodworm, and gave the queen a stronghold in the heart of Westeros to which her supporters could rally, and Rhaenyra had many such in the lands watered by the Trident. When Prince Daemon sent forth his call to arms, they rose up all along the rivers, knights and men-at-arms, and humble peasants who yet remembered the realm's delight, so beloved of her father, and the way she smiled and charmed them as she made her progress through the riverlands in her youth. Hundreds, and then thousands, buckled on their sword-belts and donned their mail, or grabbed a pitchfork, or a hoe, and a crude wooden shield, and began to make their way to Harrenhal to fight for Viserys's little girl. The lords of the Trident, having more to lose, were not so quick to move. But soon enough they too began to throw their lots in with the queen. From the twins rode Sir Forrest Frey, the very same fool Frey who had once begged for Rhaenyra's hand, now grown into a most puissant knight. Lord Samwell Blackwood, who had once lost a duel for her favour, raised her banners over Raventree. Sir Amos Bracken, who had won that duel, followed his lord father when House Bracken declared for Aegon. The Mootons of Maidenpool, the Pipers of Pinkmaiden Castle, the Roots of Harroway, the Darrys of Darry, the Maristers of Seagard, and the Vances of Wayfarer's Rest all announced their support for Aenera. The Vances of Atranter took the other path and trumpeted their allegiance to the young king. Peter Piper, the grizzled Lord of Pinkmaiden, spoke for many when he said, "I swore her my sword. I'm older now, but not so old that I've forgotten the words I said, and it happens, I still have the sword." The Lord Paramount of the Trident, Grover Tully, had been an old man even at the Great Council of 101, where he spoke for Prince Viserys. Though now failing, he was no less stubborn. He had favoured the rights of the male claimant in 101, and the years had not changed his views. Lord Grover insisted that River Run would fight for young King Aegon. Yet no such word went forth. The old lord was bedridden and would not live much longer, River Run's maester had declared. "I would sooner the rest of us did not die with him," declared Sir Elmo Tully, his grandson. River Run had no defence against Dragonfire, he pointed out to his own sons, and both sides in this fight rode dragons. And so whilst Lord Grover thundered and fulminated from his deathbed, River Run barred its gates, manned its walls, and held its silence. Meanwhile, a very different story was playing out to the east, where Jacaerys Valyrian descended upon the Eyrie on his young dragon Velmax, to win the Vale of Arryn for his mother. The maiden of the Vale, Lady Jane Arryn, was 35, 20 years his senior. Never wed, Lady Jane had reigned over the Vale since the death of her father and elder brothers at the hands of the Stone Crows of the Hills when she was 3. Mushroom tells us that this famous maiden was in truth a high-born harlot with a voracious appetite for men, and gives us a salacious tale of how she offered Prince Jacaerys the allegiance of the Vale only if he could bring her to her climax with his tongue. Septon Eustace repeats the widespread rumour that Jane Arryn preferred the intimate companionship of other women, then goes on to say it was not true. In this instance we must be grateful for Grand Maester Munkin's true telling, for he alone confines himself to the high hall of the Eyrie rather than its bedchambers. "Thrice have mine own kin sought to replace me," Lady Jane told Prince Jacaerys. "My cousin Sir Arnold is wont to say that women are too soft to rule. I have him in one of my sky cells, if you would like to ask him. Your Prince Daemon used his first wife most cruelly, it is true, but notwithstanding your mother's poor taste in consorts, she remains our rightful queen, and mine own blood besides, an Arryn on her mother's side. In this world of men we women must band together. The Vale and its knights shall stand with her, if her grace will grant me one request." When the prince asked what that might be, she answered, "Dragons. I have no fear of armies. Many and more have broken themselves against my bloody gate, and the Eyrie is known to be impregnable. But you have descended on us from the sky, as Queen Visenya once did during the conquest, and I was powerless to halt you. I mislike feeling powerless. Send me dragon riders. And so the prince agreed, and Lady Jane knelt before him, and bade her warriors to kneel, and all swore him their swords. Then on Jacaerys' sword, north across the fingers and the waters of the Bight, he lighted briefly at Sisterton, where Lord Borrell and Lord Sunderland did obeisance to him and pledged him the support of the Three Sisters, then flew on to White Harbour, where Lord Desmond Manderley met with him in his Merman's Court. Here the prince faced a shrewder bargainer. "White Harbour is not unsympathetic to your mother's plight," Manderley declared. "Mine own forebears were despoiled of their birthright when our enemies drove us into exile on these cold northern shores. When the old king visited us so long ago, he spoke of the wrong that had been done to us and promised to make redress. In pledge of that, his grace offered the hand of his daughter, Princess Viserra, to my great-grandsire, that our two houses might be made as one. But the girl died, and the promise was forgotten." Prince Jacaerys knew what was being asked of him. Before he left White Harbour, a compact was drawn up and signed, by the terms of which Lord Manderley's youngest daughter would be wed to the prince's brother Joffrey, once the war was over. Finally, Vermax carried Jacaerys Valerian to Winterfell to treat with its formidable young lord, Craegan Stark. In the fullness of time, Craegan Stark would become known as the Old Man of the North, but the Lord of Winterfell was but 21 when Prince Jacaerys came to him in 129 AC. Craegan had come into his lordship at 13, upon the death of his father, Lord Rickon, in 121 AC. During his minority, his uncle Benard had ruled the North as regent, but in 124 AC, Craegan turned 16, only to find his uncle slow to surrender his power. Relations between the two grew strained as the young lord chafed under the limits imposed upon him by his father's brother. Finally, in 126 AC, Craegan Stark rose up, imprisoned Benard and his three sons, and took the rule of the North into his own hands. Soon after, he wed Lady Arryn Norrie, a beloved companion since childhood, only to have her die in 128 AC, whilst giving birth to a son and heir whom Craegan named Rickon, after his father. Autumn was well advanced when the Prince of Dragonstone came to Winterfell. The snows lay deep upon the ground, a cold wind was howling from the north, and Lord Stark was in the midst of his preparations for the coming winter. Yet he gave Jacaerys a warm welcome. Snow and ice and cold made Vermax ill-tempered, it is said, so the prince did not linger long amongst the Northmen. But many a curious tale came out of that short sojourn. Monken's True Telling says that Craegan and Jacaerys took a liking to each other, for the boy prince reminded the Lord of Winterfell of his own younger brother, who had died 10 years before. They drank together, hunted together, trained together, and swore an oath of brotherhood, sealed in blood. This seems more credible than Septon Eustace's version, wherein the prince spends most of his visit attempting to persuade Lord Craegan to give up his false gods and accept the worship of the Seven. But we turn to Mushroom to find the tale's other chronicles omit, nor does he fail us now. His account introduces a young maiden, or Wolf-girl, as he dubs her, with the name of Sarah Snow. So smitten was Prince Jacaerys with this creature, a bastard daughter of the late Lord Rickon Stark, that he lay with her of a night. On learning that his guest had claimed the maidenhead of his bastard sister, Lord Craegan became most wroth, and only softened when Sarah Snow told him that the prince had taken her for his wife. They had spoken their vows in Winterfell's own godswood before a heart tree, and only then had she given herself to him, wrapped in furs amidst the snows, as the old gods looked on. This makes for a charming story, to be sure, but as with many of Mushroom's fables, it seems to partake more of a fool's fevered imaginings than of historical truth. Jacaerys Valerian had been betrothed to his cousin Bela since he was 4 and she was 2, and from all we know of his character, it seems most unlikely that he would break such a solemn agreement to protect the uncertain virtue of some half-wild, unwashed northern bastard. If indeed there ever lived a Sarah Snow, and if indeed the Prince of Dragonstone perchanced to dally with her, that is no more than other princes have done in the past, and will do on the morrow. But to talk of marriage is preposterous. Mushroom also claims that Vermax left a clutch of dragon's eggs at Winterfell, which is equally absurd. Whilst it is true that determining the sex of a living dragon is a nigh on impossible task, no other source mentions Vermax producing so much as a single egg, so it must be assumed that he was male. Septon Barth's speculation that the dragons change sex at need, being as mutable as flame, is too ludicrous to consider. This we do know. Craegan, Stark, and Jacaerys Valerian reached an accord, and signed and sealed the agreement that Grand Maester Munken calls the Pact of Ice and Fire in his True Telling. Like many such pacts, it was to be sealed with a marriage. Lord Craegan's son, Rickon, was a year old. Prince Jacaerys was as yet unmarried and childless, but it was assumed that he would sire children of his own once his mother sat the Iron Throne. Under the terms of the pact, the prince's firstborn daughter would be sent north at the age of 7, to be fostered at Winterfell until such time as she was old enough to marry Lord Craegan's heir. When the Prince of Dragonstone took his dragon back into the cold autumn sky, he did so with the knowledge that he had won 3 powerful lords and all their bannermen for his mother. Though his 15th name day was still half a year away, Prince Jacaerys had proved himself a man and a worthy heir to the Iron Throne. Had his brother's shorter, safer flight gone as well, much bloodshed and grief might well have been averted. The tragedy that befell Lucerys Valerian at Storm's End was never planned. On this all of our sources agree. The first battles in the Dance of the Dragons were fought with quills and ravens, with threats and promises, decrees and blandishments. The murder of Lord Beesbury at the Green Council was not yet widely known. Most believed his lordship to be languishing in some dungeon. Whilst sundry familiar faces were no longer seen about court, no heads had appeared above the castle gates, and many still hoped that the question of succession might be resolved peaceably. The stranger had other plans. For surely it was his dread hand behind the ill chance that brought the 2 princelings together at Storm's End, when the dragon Arax raced before a gathering storm to deliver Lucerys Valerian to the safety of the castle yard, only to find Aemond Targaryen there before him. Boros Baratheon was a man of much different character than his father. Lord Boromond was stone, hard and strong and unmoving, Septon Eustace tells us. Lord Boros was the wind that rages and howls and blows this way and that. Prince Aemond had been uncertain what sort of welcome he would receive when he set out, but Storm's End welcomed him with feasts and hunts and jousting. Lord Boros proved more than willing to entertain his suit. "I have 4 daughters," he told the prince. "Choose anyone you like. Cass is oldest, she'll be first to flower, but Floris is prettier, and if it's a clever wife you want, there's Marys." Rhaenyra had taken House Baratheon for granted for too long, his lordship told Aemond. "Aye, Princess Rhaenys is kin to me and mine. Some great aunt I never knew was married to her father, but the both of them are dead. And Rhaenyra? She's not Rhaenys, is she?" "He had nothing against women," Lord Boros went on to say. "He loved his girls. A daughter is a precious thing, but a son, ah! Should the gods ever grant him a son of his own blood, Storm's End would pass to him, not to his sisters. Why should the Iron Throne be any different? And with a royal marriage in the offing, Rhaenyra's cause was lost. She would see that when she learned that she had lost Storm's End. He would tell her so himself. Bow down to your brother. Aye, it's for the best. His girls would fight with each other sometimes, the way girls do, but he saw to it they always made peace afterward." We have no record of which daughter Prince Aemond finally decided on, though Mushroom tells us that he kissed all 4 to taste the nectar of their lips. Save that it was not Marys. Monken writes that the prince and Lord Boros were haggling over dates and dowries on the morning Lucerys Valerian appeared. Vhagar sensed his coming first. Guardsmen walking the battlements of the castle's mighty curtain walls clutched their spears in sudden terror when she woke with a roar that shook the very foundations of Durin's defiance. Even Arrex quailed before that sound, we are told, and Luke plied his whip freely as he forced him down. Mushroom would have us believe that the lightning was flashing to the east and a heavy rain falling as Lucerys leapt off his dragon, his mother's message clutched in his hand. He must surely have known what Vhagar's presence meant, so it would have come as no surprise when Aemon Targaryen confronted him in the Round Hall, before the eyes of Lord Boros, his four daughters, Septon and Maester, and 20 knights, guards, and servants. Amongst those who witnessed the meeting were Sir Byron Swan, second son of Lord of Stonehelm in the Dornish Marches, who would have his own small part to play later in the dance. So here, for once, we need not rely entirely on Grand Maester Monken, Mushroom, and Septon Eustace. None of them were present at Storm's End, but many others were, so we have no shortage of first-hand accounts. "Look at this sad creature, my lord," Prince Aemon called out. "Little Luke Strong, the bastard." To Luke he said, "You are wet, bastard. Is it raining, or did you piss yourself in fear?" Lucerys Valerian addressed himself only to Lord Baratheon. "Lord Boros, I have brought you a message from my mother, the queen." "The whore of Dragonstone, he means," Prince Aemon strode forward and made to snatch the letter from Lucerys's hand. But Lord Boros roared a command, and his knights intervened, pulling the princelings apart. One brought Rhaenyra's letter to the dais, where his lordship sat upon the throne of the Storm Kings of old. No man can truly know what Boros Baratheon was feeling at that moment. The accounts of those who were there differ markedly one from the other. Some say his lordship was red-faced and abashed, as a man might be if his lawful wife found him abed with another woman. Others declare that Boros appeared to be relishing the moment, for it pleased his vanity to have both king and queen seeking his support. Mushroom, who was not there, says he was drunk. Septon Eustace, who was not there, says he was fearful. Yet all the witnesses agree on what Lord Boros said and did. Never a man of letters, he handed the queen's letter to his maester, who cracked the seal and whispered the message into his lordship's ear. A frown stole across Lord Boros's face. He stroked his beard, scowled at Lucerys Valerian, and said, "And if I do as your mother bids, which one of my daughters will you marry, boy?" He gestured at the four girls. "Pick one." Prince Lucerys could only blush. "My lord, I am not free to marry," he replied. "I am betrothed to my cousin Rhaenyra." "I thought as much," Lord Boros said. "Go home, pup, and tell the bitch your mother that the Lord of Storm's End is not a dog that she can whistle up at need to set against her foes." And Prince Lucerys turned to take his leave of the Round Hall. But Prince Aemond drew his sword and said, "Hold strong. First, pay the debt you owe me." Then he tore off his eye patch and flung it to the floor to show the sapphire beneath. "You have a knife, just as you did then. Put out your eye, and I will let you leave. One will serve. I would not blind you." Prince Lucerys recalled his promise to his mother. "I will not fight you. I came here as an envoy, not a knight." "You came here as a craven and a traitor," Prince Aemon answered. "I will have your eye or your life, Strong." At that, Lord Boros grew uneasy. "Not here," he grumbled. "He came as an envoy. I want no blood shed beneath my roof." So his guards put themselves between the princelings and escorted Lucerys Valerian from the Round Hall, back to the castle yard, where his dragon, Arrax, was hunched down in the rain awaiting his return. And there it might have ended, but for the girl Maris. The second-born daughter of Lord Boros, less comely than her sisters, she was angry with Aemond for preferring them to her. "Was it one of your eyes he took? Or one of your balls?" Maris asked the prince, in tones sweet as honey. "I am so glad you chose my sister. I want a husband with all his parts." Aemond Targaryen's mouth twisted in rage, and he turned once more to Lord Boros, asking for his leave. The Lord of Storm's End shrugged and answered, "It is not for me to tell you what to do when you are not beneath my roof." And his knights moved aside as Prince Aemond rushed to the doors. Outside, the storm was raging. Thunder rolled across the castle. The rain fell in blinding sheets, and from time to time great bolts of blue-white lightning lit the world as bright as day. It was bad weather for flying, even for a dragon, and Arryx was struggling to stay aloft when Prince Aemond mounted Vhagar and went after him. Had the sky been calm, Prince Lucerys might have been able to outfly his pursuer, for Arryx was younger and swifter. But the day was as black as Prince Aemond's heart, says Mushroom. And so it came to pass that the dragons met above Shipbreaker Bay. Watchers on the castle walls saw distant blasts of flame, and heard a shriek cut the thunder. Then the two beasts were locked together, lightning crackling around them. Vhagar was 5 times the size of her foe, the hardened survivor of 100 battles. If there was a fight, it could not have lasted long. Arryx fell, broken, to be swallowed by the storm-lashed waters of the bay. His head and neck washed up beneath the cliffs below Storm's End 3 days later to make a feast for crabs and seagulls. Mushroom claims that Prince Lucerys's corpse washed up as well, and tells us that Prince Aemond cut out his eyes and presented them to Lady Maris on a bed of seaweed. But this seems excessive. Some say Vhagar snatched Lucerys off his dragon's back and swallowed him whole. It has even been claimed that the prince survived his fall, swam to safety, but lost all memory of who he was, spending the rest of his days as a simple-minded fisherman. The true telling gives all these tales the respect they deserve, which is to say, none. Lucerys Valerian died with his dragon, Munkin insists. This is undoubtedly correct. The prince was 13 years of age, his body was never found, and with his death, the war of ravens and envoys and marriage pacts came to an end, and the war of fire and blood began in earnest. Aemond Targaryen, who would henceforth be known as Aemond the Kinslayer to his foes, returned to King's Landing, having won the support of Storm's End for his brother Aegon and the undying enmity of Queen Rhaenyra. If he thought to receive a hero's welcome, he was disappointed. Queen Alicent went pale when she heard what he had done, crying, "Mother, have mercy on us all!" Nor was Ser Otto pleased. "You have only lost one eye," he is reported to have said. "How could you be so blind?" The king himself did not share their concerns, however. Aegon II welcomed Prince Aemond home with a great feast, hailed him as the true blood of the dragon, and announced that he had made a good beginning. On Dragonstone, Queen Rhaenyra collapsed when told of Luke's death. Luke's young brother Joffrey, Jace was still away on his mission north, swore a terrible oath of vengeance against Prince Aemond and Lord Boros. Only the intervention of the Sea Snake and Princess Rhaenys kept the boy from mounting his own dragon at once. Mushroom would have us believe he played a part as well. As the Black Council sat to consider how to strike back, a raven arrived from Harrenhal. "An eye for an eye, a son for a son," Prince Daemon wrote. "Lucerys shall be avenged." Let it not be forgotten. In his youth, Daemon Targaryen had been the prince of the city, his face and laugh familiar to every cutpurse, whore, and gambler in Fleabottom. The prince still had friends in the low places of King's Landing, and followers amongst the Goldcloaks. Unbeknownst to King Aegon, the Hand, or the Queen Dowager, he had allies at court as well, even on the Green Council. And one other go-between, a special friend he trusted utterly, who knew the wine sinks and rat pits that festered in the shadow of the Red Keep, as well as Daemon himself once had, and moved easily through the shadows of the city. To this pale stranger he reached out now by secret ways to set a terrible vengeance into motion. Amidst the stews of Fleabottom, Prince Daemon's go-between found suitable instruments. One had been a sergeant in the city watch. Big and brutal, he had lost his gold cloak for beating a whore to death whilst in a drunken rage. The other was a rat-catcher in the Red Keep. Their true names are lost to history. They are remembered, would that they were not, as Blood and Cheese. Cheese knew the Red Keep better than the shape of his own cock, Mushroom tells us. The hidden doors and secret tunnels that Magor the Cruel had built were as familiar to the rat-catcher as to the rats he hunted. Using a forgotten passageway, Cheese led Blood into the heart of the castle, unseen by any guard. Some say their quarry was the king himself, but Aegon was accompanied by the king's guard wherever he went, and even Cheese knew of no way in and out of Magor's holdfast, save over the drawbridge that spanned the dry moat and its formidable iron spikes. The Tower of the Hand was less secure. The two men crept up through the walls, bypassing the spearmen posted at the tower doors. Serotta's rooms were of no interest to them. Instead, they slipped into his daughter's chambers one floor below. Queen Alicent had taken up residence there after the death of King Viserys, when her son Aegon moved into Maegor's holdfast with his own queen. Once inside, Cheese bound and gagged the Dowager Queen, whilst Blood strangled her bedmaid. Then they settled down to wait, for they knew it was the custom of Queen Helena to bring her children to see their grandmother every evening before bed. Blind to her danger, the queen appeared as dusk was settling over the castle, accompanied by her three children. Jaehaerys and Jaehaera were six, Maelor two. As they entered the apartments, Helena was holding his little hand and calling out her mother's name. Blood barred the door and slew the queen's guardsman, whilst Cheese appeared to snatch up Maelor. "Scream and you all die," Blood told her grace. Queen Helena kept her calm, it is said. "Who are you?" she demanded of the two. "Debt collectors," said Cheese. "An eye for an eye, a son for a son. We only want the one to square things. Won't hurt the rest of you fine folks, not one little hair. Which one you want to lose, your grace?" Once she realized what he meant, Queen Helena pleaded with the men to kill her instead. "A wife's not a son," said Blood. "It has to be a boy." Cheese warned the queen to make a choice soon, before Blood grew bored and raped her little girl. "Pick," he said, "or we kill them all." On her knees, weeping, Helena named her youngest Maelor. Perhaps she thought the boy was too young to understand. Or perhaps it was because the older boy, Jaehaerys, was King Aegon's first-born son and heir, next in line to the Iron Throne. "You hear that, little boy?" Cheese whispered to Maelor. "Your mamma wants you dead." Then he gave Blood a grin, and the hulking swordsman slew Prince Jaehaerys, striking off the boy's head with a single blow. The queen began to scream. Strange to say, the rat-catcher and the butcher were true to their word. They did no further harm to Queen Helena or her surviving children, but rather fled with the prince's head in hand. A hue and cry went up, but Cheese knew the secret passageways as the guards did not, and the killers made their escape. 2 days later, Blood was seized at the Gate of the Gods, trying to leave King's Landing with the head of Prince Jaehaerys hidden in one of his saddle sacks. Under torture, he confessed that he had been taking it to Harrenhal to collect his reward from Prince Daemon. He also gave up a description of the whore he claimed had hired them, an older woman, foreign by her talk, cloaked and hooded, very pale. The other harlots called her Misery. After 13 days of torment, Blood was at last allowed to die. Queen Alicent had commanded Larys Clubfoot to learn his true name, so that she might bathe in the blood of his wife and children, but our sources do not say if this occurred. Sir Luthor Largent and his gold cloaks searched the Street of Silk from top to bottom, and turned out and stripped every harlot in King's Landing, but no trace of Cheese or the White Worm was ever found. In his grief and fury, King Aegon II commanded that all the city's rat-catchers be taken out and hanged, and this was done. Ser Otto Hightower brought 100 cats into the Red Keep to take their place. Though Blood and Cheese had spared her life, Queen Helena cannot be said to have survived that fateful dusk. Afterward, she would not eat, nor bathe, nor leave her chambers, and she could no longer stand to look upon her son Melor, knowing that she had named him to die. The king had no recourse but to take the boy from her and give him over to their mother, the dowager Queen Alicent, to raise as if he were her own. Aegon and his wife slept separately thereafter, and Queen Helena sank deeper and deeper into madness, whilst the king raged and drank and raged.
The Dying of the Dragons, the Red Dragon and the Gold.
The Dance of the Dragons entered a new stage after the death of Lucerys Valerian in the Stormlands and the murder of Prince Jaehaerys before his mother's eyes in the Red Keep. For both the Blacks and the Greens, blood called to blood for vengeance, and all across the realm, lords called their banners, and armies gathered and began to march. In the Riverlands, raiders out of Raventree, flying Rhaenyra's banners, crossed into the lands of House Bracken, burning crops, driving off sheep and cattle, sacking villages and despoiling every sept they came on. The Blackwoods were one of the last houses south of the Neck who still followed the old gods. Initially, both claimants to the Iron Throne flew the three-headed dragon of House Targaryen, red on black, but by the end of 129 AC, both Aegon and Rhaenyra had introduced variations to distinguish their own supporters from their foes. The king changed the colour of the dragon on his banners from red to gold, to celebrate the brilliant golden scales of his dragon Sunfire, whilst the queen quartered the Targaryen arms with those of House Arryn and House Valerian, in honour of her lady mother and her first husband, respectively. When the Brackens gathered a strong force to strike back, Lord Samwell Blackwood surprised them on the march, taking them unawares as they camped beneath a riverside mill. In the fight that followed, the mill was put to the torch, and men fought and died for hours, bathed in the red light of the flames. Ser Amos Bracken, leading the host from Stonehedge, cut down and slew Lord Blackwood in single combat, only to perish himself when a weirwood arrow found the eye-slit of his helm and drove deep into his skull. Supposedly, that shaft was loosed by Lord Samwell's 16-year-old sister, Alysanne, who would later be known as Black Alley. But whether this is fact or mere family legend cannot be known. Many other grievous losses were suffered by both sides in what became known as the Battle of the Burning Mill, and when the Brackens finally broke and fled back onto their own lands under the command of Ser Amos's bastard half-brother, Ser Raelon Rivers, it was only to find that Stonehedge had been taken in their absence. Led by Prince Daemon on Caraxes, a strong host, made up of Darris, Roots, Pipers, and Freys, had captured the castle by storm in the absence of so much of House Bracken's strength. Lord Humphrey Bracken and his remaining children had been made captive, along with his third wife and base-born paramour. Rather than see them come to harm, Ser Raelon yielded. With House Bracken thus broken and defeated, the last of King Aegon's supporters in the Riverlands lost heart, and lay down their own swords as well. Yet it must not be thought that the Green Council was sitting idle. Ser Otto Hightower had been busy as well, winning over lords, hiring sellswords, strengthening the defences of King's Landing, and assiduously seeking after other alliances. After the rejection of Grand Maester Orwell's peace overtures, the Hand redoubled his efforts, dispatching ravens to Winterfell and the Eyrie, to River Run, White Harbour, Gulltown, Bitterbridge, Fair Isle, and half a hundred other keeps and castles. Riders galloped through the night to holdings close at hand to summon their lords and ladies to court to do fealty to King Aegon. Ser Otto also reached out to Dorne, whose ruling prince, Corrin Martell, had once warred against Prince Daemon in the Stepstones, but Prince Corrin spurned his offer. "Dorne has danced with dragons before," he said. "I would sooner sleep with scorpions." Yet Ser Otto was losing the trust of his king, who mistook his efforts for inaction, and his caution for cowardice. Septon Eustace tells us of one occasion when Aegon entered the Tower of the Hand and found Ser Otto writing another letter. whereupon he knocked the inkpot into his grandsire's lap, declaring, "Thrones are won with swords, not quills. Spill blood, not ink." The fall of Harrenhal to Prince Daemon came as a great shock to His Grace, Munken tells us. Until that moment, Aegon II had believed his half-sister's cause to be hopeless. Harrenhal left His Grace feeling vulnerable for the first time. The subsequent defeats at the Burning Mill and Stonehenge came as further blows, and made the king realize that his situation was more perilous than it had seemed. These fears deepened as ravens returned from the Reach, where the Greens had believed themselves strongest. House Hightower and Oldtown were solidly behind King Aegon, and His Grace had the Arbor, too. But elsewhere in the south, other lords were declaring for Rhaenyra, amongst them Lord Costain of Three Towers, Lord Mullendore of Uplands, Lord Tarly of Horn Hill, Lord Rowan of Golden Grove, and Lord Grimm of Greyshield. Loudest amongst these traitors was Sir Alan Beesbury, Lord Lyman's heir, who was demanding the release of his grandsire from the dungeon, where most believed the former master of coin to be confined. Faced with such a clamour from their own bannermen, the castellan, steward, and mother of the young Lord Tyrell of Highgarden, acting as regents for the boy, suddenly thought better of their support for King Aegon, and decided House Tyrell would take no part in this struggle. King Aegon began to drown his fears in strong wine, Septon Eustace tells us. Sir Otto sent word to his nephew, Lord Ormond Hightower, beseeching him to use the power of Oldtown to put down this rash of rebellions in the Reach. Other blows followed. The Vale, White Harbour, Winterfell. The Blackwoods and the other river lords streamed toward Harrenhal and Prince Daemon's banners. The Sea Snake's fleets closed Blackwater Bay, and every morning King Aegon had merchants whining at him. His Grace had no answer for their complaints, beyond another cup of strong wine. "Do something," he demanded of Sir Otto. The Hand assured him that something was being done. He had hatched a plan to break the Valyrian blockade. One of the chief pillars of support for Rhaenyra's claim was her consort, yet Prince Daemon represented one of her greatest weaknesses as well. The prince had made more foes than friends during the course of his adventures. Sir Otto Hightower, who had been amongst the first of those foes, reached across the narrow sea to another of the prince's enemies, the Kingdom of the Three Daughters. By itself, the royal fleet lacked the strength to break the Sea Snake's chokehold on the gullet, and King Aegon's overtures to Dalton Greyjoy of Pike had thus far failed to win the Iron Islands to his side. The combined fleets of Tyrosh, Lys, and Myr would be more than a match for the Valyrians, however. Sir Otto sent word to the Magisters, promising exclusive trading rights at King's Landing if they would clear the gullet of the Sea Snake's ships and open the sea lanes once again. To add savour to the stew, he also promised to cede the Stepstones to the Three Daughters, though in truth the Iron Throne had never claimed those isles. The Triarchy was never quick to move, however. Lacking a true king, all important decisions in this three-headed kingdom were decided by the High Council. 11 magisters from each city made up its membership, every man of them intent on demonstrating his own sagacity, shrewdness, and importance, and winning every possible advantage for his own city. Grand Maester Graydon, who wrote the definitive history of the Kingdom of the Three Daughters 50 years later, described it as 33 horses, each pulling in his own direction. Even issues as timely as war, peace, and alliance were subject to endless debate, and the High Council was not even in session when Sir Otto's envoys arrived. The delay did not sit well with the young king. Aegon II had run short of patience with his grandfather's prevarications, though his mother, the Dowager Queen Alicent, spoke up in Sir Otto's defence. His Grace turned a deaf ear to her pleading. Summoning Sir Otto to the throne room, he tore the chain of office from his neck and tossed it to Sir Criston Cole. "My new hand is a steel fist," he boasted. "We are done with writing letters." Sir Criston wasted no time in proving his mettle. "It is not for you to plead for support from your lords like a beggar pleading for alms," he told Aegon. You are the lawful king of Westeros, and those who deny it are traitors. It is past time they learned the price of treason. First, to pay that price were the captive lords languishing in the dungeons under the Red Keep, men who had once sworn to defend the rights of Princess Rhaenyra, and still stubbornly